Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Atoms Never Touch by Misha Cardenas, forward by Adrienne Marie Brown, narrated by Misha Cardenas. For May, and Isla, all my friends who carried me through, and all our hopes for a livable future. Forward by Adrienne Marie Brown. I remember the first time I experienced the mind of Misha Cardenas. She was keynoting the Allied Media Conference in Detroit several years ago, discussing a project that involved setting up water stations throughout the desert grounds of our southern border. This direct action supported the survival of migrants running towards life through militias and border control agents hunting them. In my memory, she wore a red dress and had red lips, and I thought, this trans Latina femme is the future. A few years later, I talked with Misha about another project she was working on, converting old tires into affordable bulletproof vests for communities targeted by police. Again, I was thrilled by how her mind worked, looking past the stuck places of our oppressed conditions, looking for solutions with the things that we have available to us. Whether watching Misha dance, perform, read poems, or innovate technology, I never fail to be expanded by the range of her imagination and how it is always rooted in her rigorous self-examination and willingness to grow and change to make more possible. When I learned she was writing fiction, I knew that I was a future fan. Atoms Never Touch, the novel you are listening to, is beyond my wildest dreams, an original work of Misha Cardenas fiction as part of the Emergent Strategy series. A work of alternate universes and love between trans women, a remarkably tender story of abolition and anti-fascism, a work that satisfies and plants seeds for wanting more. I'm so grateful Misha trusted us with this novel. She is letting us see how many worlds coexist in any given moment. She is showing us how we are the portals to futures where we can be loved and held and trusted with the gifts of our own lives. Chapter 1. Cora sat on the toilet, gazing down at the beige-lined pattern of the floor tile, as it flickered and slowly tilted before reality snapped back into place. There it was again, that slow spinning feeling. She had thought it was gone, but here it was again. Along with her eye twitch and her nightmares, here was another thing that had worsened after the election. These moments when it happened, this feeling, seemed also to accompany a slowing of time. She would be sitting there and suddenly notice that her visual field was slipping, turning ever so slightly. Then came the sinking in her stomach and the thought of, oh no, it's back. The doctor said it was benign positional vertigo. She knew it was more. Vertigo didn't explain the flicker. Sitting up and sighing, she felt the familiar pain in her neck that had also returned since the election. She looked at the inside of the stall door, gray and free of dialogue, until she turned on her AUG lenses. One of her favorite things about women's restrooms, different from men's rooms, was that they were usually full of AUG graffiti. "You are beautiful, just as you are, crossed out. Just lose a few pounds. Crossed out. No shit. Crossed out. Just learn to see it. Report him at pussygrabsback.ogspot.org. Fuck emos. Date goths. Fuck goths. Date girls. Fuck everyone and enjoy it." Were just a few of the philosophical debates in the layers of scribbled words that could be seen with a slight gesture of the head that enabled or disabled the optional content in her AUG lenses. The lenses used a simple algorithm to determine which gesture the user made based on changes in visual content, no longer relying on the accelerometers of earlier, clunkier devices. She took a deep breath, centering herself before going back out into the world, looking at the stall door spacing out. She still missed Juana. She missed Juana's black curls, her voice, her tenacity. She could hear other people coming in and out of the restroom. She heard the automated announcement in the mechanical female voice. Please report any suspicious persons to airport security. Any luggage left behind may be subject to inspection or destruction. Thank you for your cooperation. Together, we can make the Cascadia Airport safer. These words always gave her pause. For so many years, her appearance had been somewhere on the suspicious spectrum. Is gender transgression suspicious? Are the skin and hair of a Latina woman suspicious? Is a Latina woman covered in tattoos wearing fierce eyeliner suspicious? Why aren't people calling airport security all day to report? I suspect that the older white woman in the seat across from me in the waiting area is planning violent actions against me because I'm not white and my gender doesn't fit into the realm of her understanding. Of course, she knew what qualifies as suspicious, and that includes anyone black, Muslim, queer, trans, and certainly anyone poor enough to lack the telltale red indicator dot in their retina, evidence of an active AUG device. She finally stood up. It was only a couple years ago that she had surgery, and when she went under to have her gender confirmed, she also got her AUG lenses. In the last few years, it had become more common for people getting any surgical procedures to have their AUG lenses implanted at the same time. Leaving her stall, she went to the sink and washed her hands. She placed her backpack on the brushed aluminum counter next to the sink. It was not long ago that this was a moment of terror for her. Before surgery, she would do this basic task as quickly as possible. In an airport, she had no idea who else might be in the bathroom. If they didn't see what they thought looked like a woman, they might stop her. They might call security. They might call the police. They might harass and detain her. She might not get where she was going. In those moments, she would focus only on her hands as she washed them, and she would never make eye contact. If no one really looked at her, they might not have the chance to evaluate where she fit. They might not use their AUG to compare and analyze her or to look up her image on the networks. Now she felt differently. She felt safer knowing that her surgery had given her the biological changes she had so deeply desired, and had also etched a series of small, nearly imperceptible changes to her face, neck, shoulders, and gluteus median structure that only the detailed algorithms of an AUG might register. By understanding the facial analysis algorithms of AUGs, as well as the body and gait analysis algorithms, surgeons were able to shift the image seen by AUG users to be undeniably female. It was one of the many ways to interact with the pattern recognition algorithms that were a normal part of vision for so many people every day. There were other more subversive uses of hacking AUG algorithms as well that Cora had only read about. She washed her hands and looked at herself in the mirror. She often even made eye contact with other women in the mirror now, and she did so, allowing her AUG to register all the details it does in such moments, calculating shared interests and match percentage based on the public elements of her dating profile, alongside the other woman's sexual availability, preferred pronoun, travel destination, and in this case, only the first initial of someone who seems to care about her privacy. But Cora wasn't interested in meeting new people. She looked at her reflection again and took a deep breath. She thought she looked tired. Her eyes were a bit red from crying, and dots of her mascara were below her eyes. She wiped them away. In the mirror, the remaining minutes and seconds until boarding time flashed transparently next to her face, so she would get to the plane on time. She had 5 minutes left, she saw as she leaned in close to wipe the mascara away. The proximity of the display to her face made her back away a bit, surprising her. 5 minutes, board flight 305 to Bogota. 4 minutes, 59 seconds, board flight 305 to Bogota. 4 minutes, 58 seconds, board flight 305 to Bogota. This display flashed in place. It wasn't slipping, and neither was anything else. Cora stood up straight, trying to see herself. Well, this would be a cliche moment in a television story about a trans woman, she thought, but it was real. Looking in the mirror was often complex for her. She grabbed her backpack with her laptop in it, the bootable USB drive with the malware, the scripts to deliver it, and all the tools she would need to get into the airplane's Wi-Fi connection without being tracked. She was not just going to let this new president put even more people in cages. For years, she'd been going to protests for prison abolition and against police brutality, but when she saw an article about the Law Enforcement Activity Portal, the LEAP, being used against striking students, she realized that it was the perfect target for an abolitionist hack. LEAP relied on a computer system with a public-facing interface, allowing local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies to access a single database of criminal records. This setup was an invitation for a hacker such as her to break in and erase everything. An airplane is a perfect place for a hack. Most internet connections are tied to specific geographic locations, so if you're detected, the feds might just come knocking on your door. But on an airplane, once you break into the Wi-Fi connection, you have a perfectly anonymous satellite internet connection with no geographic location. While there was always the risk of being trapped, Cora was confident that no one else on that airplane would have the technical know-how to distinguish a digital attacker from a passenger watching the latest trash movie on their AUG lenses. The vulnerabilities were easy enough for Cora to find and exploit. The login for LEAP might have been the biggest challenge, but she simply looked up the recent published exploits of the login system and found that the administrator had been too slow to update it. Once she was inside LEAP, her plan was simply to reverse engineer the database code that was accessed during searches. With some cross-site scripting, she could get server-side and see the database queries, the code that requests data, from federal and state criminal record databases. She simply had to change those queries to write statements into code that writes data to do some serious damage. Seriously, fucking child's play. She hoped that in this time of transition, with no records of arrest histories or convictions, a lot of people could finally be freed from their cages. Chapter 2. She held me so tenderly, one arm around my shoulders, fingers inside me, and as I shook, the molecules around us found new arrangements. The change in reality was subtle. After she was gone, I saw that some of the details in my large print of the Milky Way above my bed had changed. Only a few stars had moved. A few rocks had new ripples in their skin. The pale blue color of my clock's display was slightly different. The effects were quantum, changes in possibility maps of proton clouds. But as I fell asleep, I knew that I would never see Beatrice again. blurry ovals of blue light, crossed with lines of shadow through them, slowly moved back and forth in my vision as I awoke the next morning naked in bed, lying on my back, looking at the ceiling. I wasn't ready to get up. I rolled to my side and enjoyed the moment of Astrud Gilberto's dreamy voice languidly swaying across the notes of Bossa Nova. I looked at my arm in front of me in bed, savoring the leftover memories of pleasure from the night before. I remembered her breathing my name into my ear as she held me. Rhea. The blankets and pillowcases were covered in a print of hand-drawn vines of garnet peonies, creating a warmth I was not ready to leave. As Astrud sang of quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from my guitar, something in the notes moved something inside of me. I thought of all those I've lost in other universes, and I wept. On my side, I brought my hands to my forehead and my knees closer to my chest, shoulders shaking from crying. The warm tears dropped off my face into my hands and darkened the sheet. So many loves lost to universes I can never get back to. The kettle cried later in the morning as I cooked my breakfast. The kettle cries so loud that I always run to turn it off because the downstairs neighbor must hear it. The music moved on to the sweeping beauty of Carla Morrison. The blinds open, winter blue sunlight lighting my apartment. The slow rising on the synthesizer pad stretching out many simultaneous high notes, lifting slowly, filling out a lush space. Gradients of purple and pink, wavy lines, electric. As I fill the French press with ground coffee, the rich smell of Colombian roast embracing my awareness. The synth was punctuated with a slow, dark beat, giving the space of sound a pulsation and rhythm that leaves trails within the field created by the synthesizer, like a heart filled with both sadness and grace. I was learning to find peace and serenity, and this moment was one of my favorites of the day. Sitting, I drank my second cup of coffee, looking out my window across the bay, the land on the other side showing through the mist, the winter light in rays. Bianca and I met on MetaText, in an online group for queers in the city, a few weeks later. We chatted for the next couple hours while I watched a video stream with a friend on the couch. Browsing her photos on MetaText, I saw that she was attractive in a quiet way, which I now understand is a maternal way. Seeing photos of her holding her baby niece only made the fantasy gears in my heart turn faster. I wanted to be a mother. Our first date was the weekend I arrived in the city. I came from work, didn't even have time to change out of my black jeans, just took off my work shirt to wear the camisole underneath it with my leather jacket. I parked in a hurry. I spotted her in the street, and we just began walking together without missing a beat, as if we had already known each other, as if our molecules had the right arrangements for bonding already. It was really the pattern of codependency that was so familiar, though I didn't know it yet. She still held me at bay for weeks. One night we were making out on a park bench near her apartment, and I suggested we go to her place, but she didn't want to move too fast. If only I would have listened to her. But I couldn't. I was still living in my own reality. I hadn't really accepted the truth of my situation, the ways that my neurochemistry is different. The truth is that my brain doesn't work like other people's. I can see that now, now that I've dug into the parts of my memory that I was unable to see before. Now that I've acknowledged the trauma I experienced when I was abused as a child. It was hard to see. Writing poetry, making films about my experience wasn't enough. Every time I moved into a new reality and shifted out of the previous one, it was as if the words in my writing and the films I made to document my life had also adjusted their molecules to match the new quantum reality. It was so hard, then, to perceive the changes in front of my face, because it was a complete reality with its own logical completeness, but in a different quantum universe. I wish I knew what unique combination of cortisol, dopamine, serotonin, and oxytocin in my brain created the conditions to allow my atoms to touch those of another person. I'm sure there are people who would kill me to find out, so I can't ever let anyone know. It was months later. Months of drunken nights together, so many nights of world-making sex, so many early dawns where we realized with gleeful regret that we had to head to work again with no sleep, that the words came. We were drunk, as usual, as it had become my habit to buy a bottle of Maker's Mark for every one of our dates. Bianca was on top of me, kissing me. We were both sweaty, as we had already been making love for a long time. She sat up. "Last night I had a vision, and we're going to have a baby," she said. "I dreamed that we had a baby together. We were on a road trip through the country and had stopped by the highway to walk down to the ocean. I was splashing in the water with the baby and looking back at you while you were by the car. For some reason, my friends were there too, with you, near the car. But I knew it was real. I knew it was really our baby," she said. I knew this was just a dream. We had only been dating for a few months, and I felt so unsure of our connection the whole time. I felt like she had to be lying about something. It all seemed too good to be true. There was something about us that made the part of my brain responsible for deciding whether something was true go off and say, "No, this isn't real." But I wanted it to be true. I wanted to think we could stay together and build a family. I had lost so many lovers, so many friends, so many possible children, so many children that I had thought I was going to have, children I had planned how to care for, children I had envisioned, children I named and dreamed of, and loved before they existed, that I wanted what she was saying to be true. I ignored the part of my brain that had noticed the logical failure of the reality before me, and said, "I believe you, babe. Thank you so much for telling me. That is such a beautiful vision." She bent over me and went back to kissing me. We fucked for a long time after that. I brought her to pure bliss a few times, every time loving the fluid response from her body matching currents of neurochemicals in my brain. She couldn't bring me to that place, though. Perhaps that part of my brain that I tried to ignore now wouldn't let me fully access my body and emotions after separating from it. We held each other one last time that night, but it was too late. The intensity had been too great. The interactions of chemical bonds tumbled in my brain, building to a reaction point that couldn't be stopped. As I held her, I felt her slip away. First, the touch of my skin on hers and the feeling that my mind couldn't process of our atoms touching, which they never should have. Then, the rhythm of her sleeping breath, so calm, stopped. And I was alone in bed again. I listened to the mournful beat of an electronic song with haunting female vocals filling the darkness. The profound grief in her voice made more painful by digital filtering. As I slipped into another quantum universe, it didn't even produce an audio glitch. Not a beat was lost. The transition was smooth, but I could still find differences in this new reality. I looked at the details on the print above my bed, recognizing the changes, and tears began to stream down my face. I started to move through the series of feelings that would come. Sadness, denial, anger at her loss. I didn't want to accept that she was gone. I was again face to face with the truth that I couldn't get too close to anyone or I would lose them. Weeks later, I laid on my red couch, looking out my window at the wintry beauty of the trees, like systems of veins, the wondrous forms of evolution, and I thought of the last time I had been close to having children. Anna and I had been together for 2 years, and talked about having kids so many times. I had a clear vision of our daughter. It all ended so suddenly, so abruptly, like the quiet breaking of a bone. We met at a queer performance night in Montreal. It was a long trip to travel there, but I was so excited to be performing. I was in elaborate makeup with too much dark eyeshadow, performing a movement piece with painful themes about my history of childhood abuse. The poem I wrote for the piece played above the melancholic, dramatic strings of an Olafur Arnalds composition. The violin came in powerful pulses, followed by sweeping arcs of agony. My movement looked strained, following rigid lines, en relevé, never quite centered. As the poem moved from painful memories to present healing, the music faded into another Arnalds song, atmospheric, with long wind sounds, fog above the ocean, punctuated by a patiently reverberating tone like an electronic bell. My strained movement became a standing pose, bent, arms flowing in waves. After the performances, the audience chairs were removed and the DJ played joyously danceable tunes, the kind of old hip-hop songs that you just can't resist moving to. I was still wearing my stage makeup and had thrown on a tiny, nude-colored tube dress and heels. I had just gotten a drink at the bar when Anna looked at me from where she was dancing and gestured for me to join her. I was so surprised. Anna and I had been introduced earlier by Sylvia, the dear friend who had invited me to be part of the show. As Sylvia told me of Anna's amazing activist work, I was starstruck by her femme beauty and power. I was sure she wouldn't give me the time of day. As we danced closely, I complimented Anna's gorgeous tight purple dress with a ribbon lacing up the back. "Would you like to undo those ribbons?" she asked, looking at me with a flirty half-smile. We went back to her apartment as snow fell. I couldn't believe I was walking through the snow in such a tiny dress and a leather jacket, all I had brought with me. I didn't have a jacket warm enough for this cold city. I was totally unprepared in so many ways. She fed me homemade soup and informed me that she wasn't going to have sex with me. That wouldn't happen until our third date 2 days later. A mistake, as I always get so attached so quickly. I was afraid she would disappear in the blink of an eye. But she didn't. We stayed together. And a few months in, we started having arguments. One day we were walking home, arguing when she stopped. She said, "I've just never dated anyone with a body like yours. I think it's triggering to me." Her words wounded me. That would have been a good time for me to let things end naturally, instead of the unnatural quantum implosion my neurochemistry creates that usually tears me away from my partners. I still don't understand what happens, but I know it's anything but natural. One day I will figure it out somehow. I have to. I can't keep going in this way, losing everyone I love. No, instead of letting things end there, I dug in deeper. I don't know why I react this way. I've lost so many people that you might think a smart survival response would be to keep my distance. Cut off anyone who comes close. No, my heart and my hormones do the opposite. When things are new, I want to see everything as beautiful instead of surveying their reality. When problems arise, Instead of letting them create distance, I pull closer.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?